Lawmakers have been able to conclude that stop and frisk in New York City is being used in an abusive manner and in a discriminatory manner. We in the city of Newark don't have access to that kind of data yet. And with this new policy, Newark residents will have the same information the New Yorkers have had for many years and additional information about how Newark police practices impact immigrant communities and students. So it is our hope that once this data will begin to be released on a monthly basis, that will then trigger a vigorous conversation among Newark residents about how stop and frisk is being used in our city and whether concerns need to be raised.
Udi Ofer is executive director of the New Jersey ACLU. He spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
It's been years since Enough Said Theme was on the air here, and next Wednesday overnight, I'll be catching up on years of comics history and current events, including the mainstream, independent graphic novels, and internet comic strips with Gina Donahue and Patrick Sharp, and you, as yours truly, Ken Gale, guest host for Jim Froin's science fiction show, Hour of the Wolf, this Wednesday night, Thursday morning, July 11th, from 1:30 to 3 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Enough said.
Once they were as warm as you. Like you, they fully expected to pull back the covers and rise from their beds the next morning. They'd been to the market and bought eggs and bread for tomorrow's breakfast. They confirmed appointments with friends, students, lovers. Why, they had even picked out the clothes they meant to wear after their morning showers. But then, inevitably, they never did rise from that bed. Perhaps they never made it to the other side of the street, carrying those groceries. Maybe something went terribly wrong as they reached into the closet to retrieve their trousers. And now they are no more. Or are they? Why, here comes one now. And another. Great performers of the past on Morning Ursae, Fridays live, 10 to noon on WBAI.
And it is midnight. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. Time now for Earthwatch with Robert Knight.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring? to know the bell of freedom still rings. The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. Stop and see. When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. To know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings and welcome to a special ecological edition of Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And now we hear a special plenary of the recently concluded Left Forum, focusing on what a renewed Earth would look like under a progressive, populist, and global environmental regime. We shall hear the ideas of CUNY grad scholar Christian Parenti, Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein, and Yale senior research scholar Emmanuel Wallerstein in this episode of Earthwatch.
I'm Nancy Holmstrom, member of the board of directors of Left Forum. Welcome to 2013 Left Forum, the largest left intellectual conference in the world. For every aspect of the environmental crisis, there is a movement in opposition. Global warming, there's the climate justice movement. Food insecurity, which has increased, there's the food sovereignty movement, from our Brooklyn Food Coalition to La Via Campesina of many millions of people. There are struggles worldwide against development and dispossession, both urban and rural. Around the world, there are struggles against dams and against the privatization of water. Against the endless energy demands of our current system, there are movements to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, on oil, against hydrofracking, tar sands, coal and mountaintop removal, nuclear energy, Keystone Pipeline, and so on. So there's no need to worry, as some on the left do, that if we really face up to the catastrophic consequences of our current mode of life that people will be so depressed they will be demobilized. These movements exist all over the world, and they include an exciting renewal of indigenous movements like Idle No More in Canada. Moreover, there's a distinct eco-socialist pole emerging, which certainly understands the connection between the ecological and the economic crises. Check out their table in the book room, as well as the books. So there are exciting opportunities opening up for the left today, as implicit in all environmental struggles is the basic question of who should own the earth. Should it be individuals? Should it be corporations? Should it be all of us? Or rather, as Karl Marx wrote, quote, from the standpoint of a higher socioeconomic formation, the private property of individuals in the earth will appear just as absurd as the private property of one man in other men. Even all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath it in an improved state to succeeding generations, unquote. Well, these are among the issues that will be addressed and debated throughout the conference, as long as many, along with many, many others, having nothing to do with the environment. And starting with our plenary speakers, whom I'm going to introduce one by one before each one speaks. Our first speaker is Christian Parenti. He's a professor of sustainable development at the School for International Training, a graduate institute in Vermont, and a visiting scholar at the CUNY Graduate Center. He has authored four books, the most recent being Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. He has a PhD in sociology and geography from the London School of Economics. Welcome, Christian.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming out, and thank you to Left Forum for inviting me to speak here. It's really a tremendous honor to share the stage with Emmanuel Wallerstein and Jean Stein, who I voted for. Jill Stein. I voted for the right person, though. I can see that on the ballot. So without further ado, what I'm going to talk about tonight is the what climate change implies for the state. And the punchline is, I think that climate change means the state is coming back. And the choice is whether the state's return is in a violent and repressive form, or whether as it returns, it can also be renovated and transformed, and its progressive and democratic features enhanced. And this, the simple fact that causes this is that climate change leads to extreme weather. Extreme weather leads to crisis and emergency, social, political, and economic crisis, disasters. And in those moments, who or what steps forward? At one level, people, right? At a micro level, people, communities come together and try and help each other. We've seen that here in New York in the wake of Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. And Rebecca Solnit has written eloquently about this in a historical perspective. But at a macro level, what steps up? The state steps up. The state comes back. And it's not the private sector. It's the public sector that responds. And it's important that the left think about the state, rethink the state, and reclaim it, because I don't think it can be avoided. To some extent, this idea came to me in New Orleans when I was covering the storm, Hurricane Katrina, for The Nation. And I got there the third day after the storm. And, you know, the place was covered with cops. And then the 82nd Airborne arrived. And from the outside, it looked like the police were there to repress people. And there was a lot of that going on. But that was mostly actually the New Orleans Police Department doing that. What was going on, actually, was a lot of small towns in the South wanted to help. And the only spare capacity they had in their public sector was repressive. It was guns, it was SWAT teams, it was armored personnel carriers, all of which were the direct result of 30 years of federally funded war on drugs, in which welfare and job training programs were cut, and military hand-me-down hardware was given to local states, training was subsidized, et cetera, et cetera. So you had these states, these local governments, that weren't all about going into New Orleans and cracking heads and, you know, keeping this African-American city under heel. When you're actually there on the street talking to people, they wanted to help these cops. Like, they wanted to get people out of roofs. But they didn't have some sort of civil defense infrastructure. What they had was the toolkit of repression that the federal government had produced at a local level. So it's really important that we try and reshape the state. I'll get into more about this in a second. But first, let's just get clear on some of the basic science, some of which was discussed already. We are past the point of this crisis potentially becoming self-propelling. We're at 400 parts per million of atmospheric concentrations of CO2. The best science in the world thinks that 350 parts per million is the safe cutoff point. So we have to get way back in terms of our emissions. We have to have net negative emissions. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body designed to vet science for policymakers, recommends that there should be 90% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2050, which would mean 10% per annum at least, starting now. So this is a very daunting task. And the risk in all this is that if we don't cut emissions, which is to say mitigate the problem, adaptation, dealing with what's coming down the pike, might become impossible. And that at a certain point, the breakdown of natural systems can become self-propelling. So if the planet gets warm enough and the permafrost melts and the methane that is trapped beneath the Arctic permafrost comes out, that would accelerate global warming. Methane is a heat-trapping gas 20 times more powerful than CO2. But it would be a process that would have escaped the control of human civilization. Right now, the main cause of greenhouse gas emissions is land use and burning fossil fuels. So it's still within our control to stop this. But it won't always be that way if we don't act quickly. Another thing I think is important to think about when addressing the problem of climate change, it can look so apocalyptic and so bleak that because the implications are so totalizing for human civilization and for life on Earth, James Hansen goes the furthest in his last book, Storms of My Grandchildren, where he outlines what he calls the Venus syndrome. You know, if these self-fueling processes of emissions kick in, then there could be a thousand-year process of heating on the planet that would wipe out all life. So because of the potential implications of this are so apocalyptic and so global, we can easily confuse climate change with all of the other environmental problems and think that we have to solve everything to be able to solve this. And actually, I think we should see climate change as a subset, a doable problem that can be dealt with that is the most urgent because of the time frame of the problem applied by the science. But it's not the same as dealing with all of the environmental problems. So if we deal with climate change by, you know, getting off of fossil fuel, that doesn't mean we have solved the problem of soil erosion, of deforestation, of overfishing, of increased toxicity in the atmosphere. So this is, I hope, somewhat empowering to think about how, okay, this is actually not everything. This is one subset of a larger problem. It's a problem we have to deal with so we can buy time to deal with other problems. And the fact of the matter is human civilizations have been able to do that, and even capitalism has been able to do that, and even American capitalism has been able to deal with environmental crises and mitigate them at a local, regional level, not perfectly, but to some extent. So back to this question of the state. So the state either comes back, as I saw it in New Orleans, as repression, or it comes back as some sort of progressive, democratic, transformed institution. And I think that this, it's important to understand when discussing the state, because it's something I think it's really kind of fallen out of fashion to discuss the state, write about the state, think about the state on the US left. And I think that's a really, really big problem. The other side hasn't. They still take the state very seriously and invest heavily in controlling it. But neoliberalism, in all its rhetoric, anti-statist rhetoric, has, it seems to me, been able to almost disappear the state as a category of left thought. So I would like to suggest to you that actually the state is fundamental to capitalist development, and that the way it's fundamental is partly in that it manages nature for capitalism. And this is, these are ideas that are coming from this book that I'm currently working on. And this history is important because I think we have to see it clearly to think about how to go forward. So what I'm arguing is that at the heart of the development of American capitalism is a type of shadow socialism, which is fundamentally about managing nature for capitalism, for capital, delivering nature to capital. And you can see this if you connect a few explicitly, implicitly linked ideas. First, here's a little theoretical digression here. First, accept that the capitalist state, by definition, whatever else, must reproduce the conditions of accumulation. Second, acknowledge the importance of non-human nature's use values in the accumulation process. And third, think about the state's territoriality. I'll get back to this in a second. Marx was very clear, though not all Marxists for a long time, or economists after, were, that nature provides use values to capital, which through the labor process are converted into exchange values. And this is a key point for understanding the rest of his thinking. And while we're on that subject, let me give props to people like John Bellamy Foster and Michael Perlman and others who are here who, beginning in the 90s, began to really piece together these disparate references to nature in Marx's work, and out of that concoct a sort of, you know, coherent Marxist theory of capitalism and the environment. So in the Critique of the Gotha Program, Marx puts it this way: labor is not the source of all wealth. Nature is just as much the source of use values, and it is surely of such that material wealth consists just as much as labor, which itself is only a manifestation of a force of nature, human labor power, unquote. So in this statement, Marx does two things. He places human beings within nature, and more and the second thing he does is note that non-human nature provides use values to the valorization process, the accumulation process. That is not only the piece of nature which is human labor, but it's the rest of nature as well. So in making a table, part of what, or making this podium, part of what provides the value is the utility of the wood, which exists outside of the labor process, exists to some extent autonomously, and that those values are important for capital accumulation. So then, if that's true, where do we find the use values of nature? Where are they located? And what delivers them to capital? Ultimately, it's the state, is the context in which nature is delivered to capital. And it's the territoriality of the state that facilitates that. Recall Weber's classic definition, which, you know, was his formulation arrived at on the eve of the uprising in Bavaria in 1919, sort of a revolutionary moment. He's clearly in dialogue with Leninism when he tells his audience that we can say that the state is the human community that successfully claims the monopoly of the legitimate use of force within a given territory. Note that territory is one of the characteristics of the state. Indeed. So, what does that mean? Well, I think it's clear, it's best explained in the history of the United States. Beginning at the birth of the Republic, even before that, but the birth of the Republic in many ways starts with the federal government has this constitution, but it really doesn't have anything. The 13 colonies are now 13 states, and they're all heavily indebted. And under the guidance of Hamilton, brokering deals with Jefferson and Madison, the federal government buys out the state debts from the Revolution in exchange for the state's land claims. And the states had these enormous land claims. And so in exchange for creating the first bank, which Hamilton wanted, and paying off at face value the worthless war debts of the states, the federal government acquired all of the land that we take for granted as it having. It then proceeds to use this quite intentionally, and Hamilton writes about this in great detail, to use this land to achieve economic development, to bring forth what becomes capitalism. They don't refer to it as capitalism. And the land and the natural use values of it are crucial to how American capitalism came to be. This is all part and parcel of what Henry Clay called the American system. And the idea was to use the state as a sort of hothouse for economic development. Henry Clay, among others, you know, wanted to have sort of national universities, national observatories, a national bank, national road system, et cetera, et cetera. This project was ultimately defeated by the South, mostly, which didn't want a strong federal government. But to the extent that it did succeed, it laid the basis for the country we now see. So canals were the first internal improvement that was attempted. And 4.5 million acres of land were given to these canal companies. Whole fortunes and regions were born out of that. Canals were quickly pushed aside in the 1830s by railroads. 174 million acres of land, public land, were given to the railroads by the federal government. Another 49 million acres were given by states. This is, the federal grants alone are the area of California twice. They were full of resources like forests, waterways, minerals, which these railroad companies sold off and got enormously rich on. And the effect, the businesses born out of that moment are with us today and continue to this day. So on and on. So these are like aspects of this shadow socialism. Land grant colleges. How is it that the United States got such an amazing public university system? It was, again, this grant of land to colleges is the basis for the development of the university system. And it was against this land that the universities or the railroad companies could then borrow. But the land granted by the state, which guarantees the property rights of that land, is the key element in all this. This goes beyond the question of nature, this issue of hidden social, the shadow socialism, to so many other aspects of life. The press, the vibrant press that this country had in the 19th century. Why did that happen? Because the federal government subsidized it. It bought ads at very high rates. It allowed small papers to ship through the mails at very low prices. And that is what helped build that heyday of American journalism. Moving forward into industrial technology, you can pick pretty much any industrial technology, and there's this history of shadow socialism there. Aviation got its start because the government bought up all patents and allowed anyone to use the information. When the first airlines began, the federal government paid them large amounts of money, more than was necessary, to move the mails. Once they could fly sufficiently, making money on moving the mails, then they could take on passengers. War, of course, is the ugly side of this. War becomes an industrial laboratory where the state frequently would step in and reorganize whole industries. World War I, the federal government stepped in and reorganized completely the national rail system. Aviation, medicine, all of those aspects of technology get a great boost forward in war as well. It would be nice to do that without having to go to war. Then comes the New Deal, in which this moment, this aspect of shadow socialism becomes explicit, and there is an attempt to get out of this crisis by using the state to jumpstart capitalism, to redistribute wealth to people, to create markets by giving poor people jobs and money so that they can buy stuff so industry can turn over, and also the state purchasing stuff itself. So this brings me to the present and what I think is a realistic solution to this very pressing short-term problem. The government has to act, and we have to demand that it act in in ways that will get us off fossil fuels. The good news is, and I know Jill will talk more about this, we have the ingredients we need to cut carbon emissions. We have the money, we have the technology, and we have the enabling legislation. The great tragedy of the Obama administration, its first 2 years, was that much of the environmental left and others got very involved in trying to pass climate legislation, comprehensive climate legislation. And there were a few marginal voices among them, the Center for Biological Diversity, saying, you know what, we don't need any new laws, we have them. It's the Clean Air Act from 1970. And the story is that when Clinton signed the Kyoto Protocol and the Senate didn't ratify it, Massachusetts and green groups sued the federal government and 10 years later eventually won. And they said, hey, look, CO2 emissions endanger human health, therefore they must be covered under the Clean Air Act of 1970. The Supreme Court in 2007 said, yes, that's true. George Bush ignored this, and so too did Obama in his pursuit of comprehensive climate legislation. Now people are turning around realizing, well, that was not just some fringe position. Indeed, the implications of Massachusetts versus EPA are that we have the legislation to impose a crippling carbon tax on the fossil fuel sector. Out of this endangerment finding, that CO2 is dangerous, comes a slew of tailoring rules. So the first thing that was done pursuant to Massachusetts versus EPA was a regulation of emissions from automobiles. Then there was emission standards for new coal-fired power plants. And those standards were so strict that there will not be any new coal-fired power plants built in this country. That was unfortunately an easy thing for Obama to do because natural gas was coming online, filthy fracking gas was coming online and basically making it uneconomical to build new coal plants anyway. So we're waiting for numerous rules relating to aviation, shipping, oil refineries, cement plants, you name it. We're waiting for rules from the EPA, and Obama has been keeping the EPA on a very tight leash. But the law is there. It is not out of the question that we could start imposing penalties on polluters that would mean that they would essentially have to switch to a different fuel because the cost would be so high. We have the technology, solar, wind, appropriate hydro, all of that exists. The problem is scaling it up. So how to scale it up? Well, that gets back to this history of shadow socialism. One of the key things the government has done for capitalism is not direct subsidies with production, but providing markets, consuming the products. So the federal government and the state governments combined constitute more than 35% of GDP. This is a talking point that the right makes great hay of, but the left, I don't think, does enough with. The right sees this as a problem. This is potentially a huge solution. In other words, the one-third of the economy is theoretically accountable to the people, that we could get the federal government to get off fossil fuels. This is not out of the question. The federal government has huge vehicle fleets, has huge building fleets. All of this could be moved towards using clean forms of energy, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, there was an executive order issued by Obama moving in that direction, but then nothing came of it because there was such pushback from the right. So if the post office were to switch to electric vehicles, that would have the effect of helping to lower the cost of electric vehicles in general so that the private sector could take this on. And there's numerous other examples like that I could go through, and I have in other places since the end of my book. But since I'm out of time, I'll just leave you with that and one apology or explanation, which is I know this doesn't sound particularly revolutionary or radical, but what I'm trying to do is be very, very realistic. Because I don't think it's okay or sufficient to be outraged about this and invoke the righteousness of our cause. We have to come up with credible solutions and stories that will really work, and we have to have strategies that work at different time frames. So, okay, what I've suggested here is not the solution to all problems associated with capitalism. It's not even the solution to the environmental crisis. It's just a realistic solution or approach to dealing with climate change so as to buy time, so as to pull back from the brink, so that we can continue struggling. And if we don't take things that seriously and get comfortable with the contradictions implied in that, I think we will not be able to address this. But, you know, we do have the means to do it, economically, technologically, and it's thus just a matter of politics. And that, as you all know, is about movements. Movements that have to be strong and demand a lot and cause disruptions for business as usual that can only be placated by serious economic and policy change. So, on that note, thank you.
Our second speaker is Dr. Jill Stein, the 2012 Green Party presidential candidate, and I also voted for you. She has co-authored two reports called In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development, and Environmental Threats to Health and Aging, which promote green local economies and power, sustainable agriculture, and freedom from toxics. A graduate and former instructor at Harvard Medical School, Stein is also a physician and a pioneering environmental health advocate. She currently serves as president of the Green Shadow Cabinet, a group that debunks current federal policies and raises the bar for economic and ecological transformation. Welcome, Dr. Jill Stein.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for that kind introduction, and thank you all so very much to be here. It's really humbling just to be in this room, let alone up on the stage, with all the vision and dedication that's packed inside these four walls, and that we have come together across such a spectrum of economy and ecology gives me great hope for what we can do in this incredible historic moment that we're in right now. So I was asked to say a few words from the perspective of being a physician involved with environment and health. So first I want to just explain what my perspective is from that point of view. And having started out as a clinical doctor, doing sort of the routine medicine for grown-ups, basically, I discovered I was not comfortable giving people pills and pushing them back out to the things that are making us sick. Everything from pollution to poverty to a sick food system and a dirty, polluting, car-centered, passive transportation system and so on. But what I discovered when I moved into the world of environmental health, and I discovered that there was really no way to improve our health and the environment unless we were also transforming the economy. The two are just too connected. And what I learned there as a physician and an advocate was that you can't really change the economy unless you challenge power. So when people ask me now what kind of medicine I'm practicing, I say political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses, and we've got to fix this one. In order to fix all the other things that are literally killing us. Now, the medical licensing board is a little bit puzzled by this in my home state in Massachusetts, especially by the three arrests last year. But they are allowing me to keep my license even as a practitioner of political medicine, so far, at least. So, fingers crossed. So I want to share some thoughts from that perspective of political medicine on how we can get to this ecologic and economic transformation. And in a nutshell, personally, I'm convinced that this is actually within our reach, The powers that be go to great lengths to convince us that it's not, but the fact that they have to work so hard to persuade the 99% that we are actually controlled by the 1%, I think speaks volumes about where power really lies. And I think that, you know, basically using the strength of our numbers as the 99% and the strength of our agenda as an agenda that really is supported by the majority of Americans and poll after poll, that has enormous power. So I'm basically here to encourage us to use the power that we already have to achieve the transformation we deserve that our survival actually does depend on. So first, I want to make 3 points. And first, I want to sort of point out the obvious, that we are in this incredible historic moment where democracy and justice are basically breaking out all around us. And that really does, I think, just create a whole different landscape for what we can now achieve. So, you know, we're seeing the democracy revolutions in the Middle East that just took a great leap forward last week, this week actually, with the incredible uprisings now in Turkey and the incredible courage of the people out in the street. 2,000. It's just amazing to see the footage of what's going on there. You know, the police have been so incredibly brutal. 2,000 people have been injured, but they are just going strong. People are absolutely undeterred. It's very exciting. So there's that going on throughout the Middle East. The Occupy and the austerity uprisings, these are, you know, really big, enormous movements. And then we have many smaller movements as well, which are basically everywhere you look. From the tar sands blockade to the teacher and student protests, from Puerto Rico to Cooper Union. And not to mention Quebec and the high school uprisings, from Philadelphia to Seattle and Chicago. The strikes at both at fast food industry and at Walmart, the strikes of these workers, eviction blockades across the country, the Idle No More campaign, the fights to stop fracking and nuclear power. I don't know if you've heard, but that took a great leap forward today, too, where it was announced that San Onofre is closed for now and forever. So keep working on Indian Point. It won't be far behind. In spite of, you know, the millions, the billions that they are spending to bribe our elected officials and to propagandize people, the nuclear power industry is moving backwards still, even despite Obama's efforts to create a new generation of nuclear power plants. The people are saying no, and that industry is looking at its days being numbered. And I have to mention the incredible millions out in the street last week to stop that poster child of predatory capitalism, Monsanto. And, you know, that was an incredible demonstration that did involve literally millions of people. It just self-organized on Facebook. You know, it was just very exciting. So people are standing up like we haven't seen for generations. This movement is long overdue, but maybe it's just in time for us to make this a powerful tipping point, to start taking back the promise of democracy and the peaceful, just, green future that we deserve. The more united we are, obviously, behind a unified front, the more powerful we will be in working for a broad agenda of economic and ecologic transformation, and the quicker we'll get there. Because the 1% cannot rule the 99% without the game of divide and conquer. So by our being here today, across the spectrum of so many issues, we begin to beat back that game of divide and conquer, and to create a more effective mobilization. And standing up to power, I would argue, requires not only standing up to the capitalist establishment, but also to its political parties. Capitalism thrives on the politics of fear. But the reality is the politics of fear has actually brought us everything that we were afraid of. All those reasons we were supposed to just hold our noses and get along, go along to get along. You know, we actually got everything we were supposed to avoid by playing out that strategy. The meltdown of our climate, the offshoring of our jobs, the massively expanding war effort, which is everywhere for all time right now, basically, the attack on our civil liberties, the massive, more massive bailouts of our banks. This is what the politics of fear has actually brought us. So it's really important, I think, to replace the politics of fear with the politics of courage in the street and in the voting booth. We have to lead the way for what we deserve, because they're not going to. We've got to do it. And, by the way, I want to just add that this is not a contest between economy and ecology to see which one is more important. That's like asking, is your heart or your lungs more critical to surviving? You know, it's not a choice between them. We need them both. They're both essential. And they're both so enmeshed with each other, we can't possibly fix one without fixing the other, in my opinion. If you try to fix the economy and you let the environment unravel, you won't have the water to cool your engines, you won't have the food to feed our families, you won't have the climate security from storms and drought and floods to set up shop, let alone even have a place to live. And likewise, if you try to fix the environment, but you haven't fixed the economy and made it green and made it democratized it, if you haven't done that, then people will, of necessity, take down the trees and overgraze the land and overfish the fish in a desperate scramble to survive. So these things really go together. And in my view, you know, I just don't see how we fix these things without also addressing the issue of peace and democracy. The military is the biggest source of greenhouse gases on the planet. And conversely, securing, or I should say stealing, fossil fuels from the third world is the biggest driver of our military. So piecemeal solutions, in my view, don't do it, although they can get us going. They can get things started. But ultimately, we really do need a holistic vision and holistic solutions. And we can do that because the solutions are not only compatible, they're profoundly synergistic and interdependent. So my second point is that this transformation is not only possible, it's essential. And in fact, as Maggie Thatcher used to say, but for different reasons, there is no alternative. Take that, Maggie Thatcher. The climate science right now makes that really clear. So that there is no alternative. We really have to take this thing by the horns, but in doing that, we can actually resuscitate our economy, which is going down the tubes if we let it continue as it is. So this is actually a good thing. And the climate science compels us to get moving with emergency action right now, both for the climate and for the economy. And a simple way to understand climate science is basically just this, that warming creates more warming. There are these physical points called tipping points that Christian was referring to. And when you get to those physical conditions of that tipping point, it just triggers a whole lot more warming, which in turn triggers other tipping points, and you get more warming. And there is no end. There's this myth out there, kind of a misconception that, oh, it's not so bad. We'll get a degree or two warmer. But hey, that's not such a bad thing. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. And they don't actually tell you that. The problem is warming then becomes, it's a verb. It's not, you know, an adjective. It's not like it's a warm world. It's a world that continues to heat up until it has become, you know, quite unlivable. And that is much sooner than the science has predicted. And then the science keeps catching up as it finds out more. And, you know, basically we don't have time to lose. We really need to get on this. And so I'm just going to give you a couple of the factoids that really do light a fire under your feet, and no pun intended there. So right now it's estimated that almost 500,000 people a year are dying from climate change, mostly in the third world, but it is coming home to roost as well. And that includes 1,000 children a day. This is largely from drought and flood and starvation, as well as infectious disease related to polluted water sources. So these are linked to climate change, and there's a humongous impact on the global economy, over $1 trillion a year, and these costs are growing. Just recently, we had the warmest decade on record, the decade just passed. And what kind of brings that home is that if you look at all the warming that's taken place since the start of the industrial era, like in the late 1800s, it's only 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. But here's the kind of nerve-wracking thing. Almost all of that has happened in just like the last 2 to 3 decades. So this is really accelerating. It's not just in your mind that you're seeing this take off. It really is taking off. And the last 2 years have broken all records for extreme weather. We now have established mega drought. That's a whole new term for it. Have people heard of this? Is that familiar to you at all? Mega drought. That's what they're calling the condition now in the South and in the West. You know, it means we got a really bad drought, and there is no off date for this. It's said to be with us for the long haul now. That's why, for example, we're now having these wildfires in California. We just had the second big wildfire that's near Los Angeles, has actually threatened lots of homes. I think it was over 1,000 homes that had to be evacuated around LA with the last wildfire just a month ago. And these are the kind of fires you used to see at the end of a long, hot, dry summer. Now we're seeing them, you know, right at the beginning of the spring. And let me tell you what got me off my seat about climate change, because I was working on toxics, on environmental justice and toxic pollution, basically, and in consumer products and food and water and all that. And I happened to read an article in Scientific American in 2008 about the melting of the ice sheets. And it made me realize, oh my God, you know, this really can't wait. And the deal is, this is speeding up in the last 10 to 15 years, fivefold, 500%. Increase in the melting of Greenland. And so, you know, you hear about now these earthquakes and so on going on in Greenland because there's so much water that's been pouring off of the bedrock there that it's causing earthquakes. And the bottom line is we used to think, oh, don't worry, it takes thousands of years to melt a big glacier. Well, Jim Hansen, you know, the sort of guru of climate science here in the U.S., he's doing a paper about this right now. We'll hear the results later this summer. But what he said was, you know, that unfortunately doesn't apply to our situation now. That was like during the really gradual warming that we've had on and off over the past couple million years with these ice ages that came and went. It took thousands of years to melt the likes of Greenland, but we are not in that state right now. We've had massive output of CO2, and the levels have gone up really quickly. So he's saying now, don't think 1,000 years, think decades. Now, what would it mean if Greenland were to break up and melt? It's not a foot or 6 feet or 10 feet. It's 24 feet of sea level that would rise, basically, you know, over the course of perhaps a decade or two. Nobody knows when this might possibly occur, but at any rate, it sort of got me out of my chair, you know, to start really thinking about and talking about climate and looking for how we can fix this in a way that can also fix the other things that are also critical and urgent problems. I want to say one other thing, and that is about heat waves, because that too is something we don't talk very much about, but this is very real. When we have a heat wave right now, it might go up to 105 degrees. But with the warming we're looking at, maybe as soon as 2050, they're talking not about 105 degrees, but about 117 or 120 degrees. That will be your routine heat wave. And, you know, it's not only people that can't survive that. Say, just pretend you had an air conditioner you could rely on. There's a whole lot of livestock out there that a whole lot of people need to feed us. So, you know, we don't even want to go there. I mean, here's another place we don't want to go. If Greenland were to melt, it's not just Greenland, because the stuff that is melting Greenland is also melting the Antarctic, which holds way more water than Greenland. And that's another 190 feet of sea level in the Antarctic. So, you know, the bottom line is that this is not a choice, you know. There really is no alternative. We don't want to get that far into the cycle that we're looking at the breakup of these massive ice sheets. Because once they start to break up, you can't stop them. We have to stop this process right now. And that means no new sources of fossil fuels, no fracking, no tar sands, no exploring the Arctic for oil and gas. And it means beginning to back off as quickly as humanly possible from our existing fossil fuel sources. We hear a lot about all of the above. Did you hear about that during the campaign and during the State of the Union address and the inaugural address? It's all of the above. You know, don't worry. We're going to build as many pipelines as we can. I love pipelines. Remember that? But don't worry, because we're also going to have some renewable energy. But you know what? Nature doesn't look at it that way. Fossil fuels are toxic to the climate. It's like saying for your kid, I'm going to give my child a diet of pesticides and arsenic and lead, but don't worry, it's okay, because I'm also giving them spinach and blueberries and, you know, healthy lentils or something. You know, it doesn't work that way. You can't poison your kid and you can't poison the climate. So that's what we're going to do. And fortunately, we can do that at the same time that we solve a whole host of other economic ills. It does require systemic transformational change and on an emergency basis. But it's not rocket science. This is, you know, the components of this blueprint are all over the place. And they're actually being used. This is not new stuff. This isn't experimental. This is just doing what's already available to us to do. And one blueprint for this is a plan that we talked about during our Green presidential campaign, put together in part by the Green Party here in New York, a terrific plan called the Green New Deal. Thank you, Five. Great. The Green New Deal. And our Green Shadow Cabinet, by the way, continues to talk about this and promote it. It would create 25 million jobs right now that would end unemployment, put everybody back to work, while it democratizes and greens the economy, halts climate change, and makes wars for oil obsolete. We've done something like this before. With the New Deal, we can do it again. We don't really have a climate crisis so much as a democracy crisis. We can do this. We can fix it. We just need a democracy that will work in our interests, not in the interests of the 1%. So, you know, in brief, that creates an economic bill of rights that ensures the right to a job for everyone who wants to work. It ensures living wages, safe workplaces, union representation, Medicare for all, tuition-free education from preschool through college. It will end student debt and homeowner debt, create a right to decent, affordable housing, and halt foreclosures. It would create accessible, affordable utilities, which are publicly owned and run at cost and not for profit. a right to fair taxation. You know, this is not rocket science. It's also not outrageously expensive. It's been costed out. It would cost less than the price of the first stimulus package, which created 2 or 3 million jobs, and it didn't create many because it was predominantly tax breaks. Tax breaks don't create jobs. You give it away and cross your fingers. But FDR knew how to create jobs. We can directly create government jobs. And we can do that to the tune of 25 million and do it quickly. And, you know, the Green New Deal also calls for real democracy reforms, too, to ensure that this transformation is actually implemented and it stays implemented. And that includes full public financing, free and equal access to the airwaves, which would dramatically undercut the cost of political campaigns. They would cost almost nothing if we freed up the airwaves, which would make public financing very feasible. We call for revoking corporate personhood. With an amendment to the Constitution, restoring the vote to former offenders who've done their duty, who deserve their vote, and so on. Abolishing the Electoral College and implementing instant runoff voting and proportional representation. And finally, it also calls for protecting our civil liberties, repealing the Patriot Act, the key sections of the NDAA, and ending the president's unconstitutional imperial war powers, prohibiting Homeland Security and the FBI from conspiring with police, ending the war on the press and on whistleblowers and immigrants, cutting the military, and bringing our troops home. One out of every two Americans is either in poverty or low income. One out of three African-American young men are in prison on parole or probation. 37 million students and recent graduates are effectively indentured servants with student debt. You start putting these numbers together, and we are an unstoppable force for transformational change. So, you know, I just want to say, if there's a catastrophe in the making, it's not really the climate. The real catastrophe is the myth of powerlessness that restrains us from fixing these eminently fixable crises in our climate and our economy. In fact, we are powerful. To paraphrase Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. But we do have it. And we actually have the support, the solutions, and the values that are shared by the majority of people in this country and around the world. We have the power. We just have to stand up and assert it in the street and in the voting booth and get organized to do it. So we are facing the breaking point for people, the planet, the economy, and our democracy. It's our job. It's our privilege, it's our duty, however you look at it, maybe it's just our destiny to turn this breaking point that we face into the tipping point that we need to take back our democracy, the promise of our democracy, and the peaceful, just, green future we deserve. And we can do that by mobilizing for economic and ecologic transformation and settling for nothing less. We can go a long way to jumpstart that process right here, right now, this weekend. Thank you all for being here and all you've done to make this possible. Thank you so much.
This is on WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight, and we're listening to a symposium on global ecology. Up next, Emmanuel Wallerstein.
He's the senior research fellow at Yale University. He's the author of World System, and most recently, European Universalism, the Rhetoric of Power. He was the director of the Fernand Braudel Center, the president of the International Sociological Association, and chair of the International Gulbenkian Commission for the Restructuring of the Social Sciences, whose report is Open the Social Sciences. That sounds good, right? I heard him speak just in the previous session, and he's contributed, he mentioned that he's contributed to a book called Does Capitalism Have a Future? So I think we have to get that.
Actually, this is the second Left Forum I've been to, but the last one was so long ago, people have forgotten about it. The message we are hearing is that the world is going to pot and very fast, and I entirely agree. However, the real question is, what should we do about it? Now, I just gave a session called Station With Me, in which I spoke for a half an hour. I spoke for an hour, condensing what I should have taken several hours, if not more, to say, and I cannot condense it further. But I have to tell you the bottom line of what I said in order to talk about the issues I've been raised today. All systems have lives. That's true of the tiniest system that we can conceive of to the entire universe. Come into existence at a certain point, for certain reasons, and that has to be explained. They have a normal life, and they have rules that govern this normal life, and they have to be elucidated, but they have internal contradictions which culminate at a certain point such that the system is a structural crisis, which means it cannot survive as that. And there's a bifurcation and two alternative possibilities. Now, I'm not going to explain to you the whole line behind that argument, but what I am saying, have been saying for quite some while, is that the capitalism is a world system, that this system has been incredibly successful for 500 years, that it has now reached a point where it is in structural crisis. It will not, cannot possibly survive. It's been in structural crisis. Yeah, it's not a matter of applauding because it's just it's a factual statement. It's not a statement of desire. It's a statement of what is happening, right? And this system. This system has been in structural crisis since at least the early 1970s and will be in structural crisis for another 20 to 40 years. I project 2050 is sort of the end of it. That whole period of time is a period of structural crisis and therefore of chaos. And chaos means enormous fluctuations that are uncontrollable and a bifurcation into two alternative outcomes. One alternative outcome, I just give them names. I call one the spirit of Davos, and one the spirit of Porto Alegre. And the spirit of Davos is to have a new system, which is not capitalist, you don't have to be capitalist, but which shares the three basic faults of capitalism, which is hierarchy, exploitation, polarization. You can do that in many ways. Capitalism is only one way you can do that. And these people want to replace capitalism. It has to be replaced. So something's no longer working for capitalists. And they are no longer able to really make significant profit and therefore significant capital accumulation. So capitalists want the end of this system as much as we do. But they want to replace it with a system which meets their demands. We want to replace it with a system that's relatively democratic and relatively egalitarian. We're not democratic now. There is no democratic state in the world system. There has never been a democratic state in the world system. We're certainly not an egalitarian system. So this is our basic choice. Political complexities of struggling to have it tilt in one direction rather than in the other. Okay? Now, let me get to what I call... So, we're going to... By 2050, we'll be in a different system. But it may be worse than the system we're in now, and it may be incredibly better. And the odds are 50-50. Now, those are pretty good odds, actually. But there's nothing I can say or do, or you can say and do, that will guarantee that we'll win. It's just a matter of struggle. Now, there are what I call the three imponderables, which we've been talking about so far. One imponderable is, roughly speaking, the environmental crisis. One imponderable is pandemics, and one imponderable is nuclear warfare. Now, look, all of those have their roots in the capitalist system. Of course, they are the outgrowth and the consequence of the system. And nonetheless, they have a certain internal life. I wrote an article 15 years ago saying there's this environmental crisis, and there's no exit from it within the framework of the capitalist system. Because the, let's just take one kind of part of that environmental crisis. All production of any kind creates toxicity. And the question is what you do with the toxicity. And in the capitalist system, what you do is you dump it in the river. Huh? No, that's quite serious. You literally dump toxicity in the river, right? You can do many other things, right? Now, the problem is, over time, if you dump for 500 years, you get to the point where the rivers are not viable for the fish, for people, for anything, right? So what can you do about it? Well, you can clean it up, right? That is to say, governments can make the decision that they have toxic environments and they're going to spend money cleaning it up. Question is, where do they get that money? Obviously, the place they get that money is from some form of taxation or choosing not to do X and to do Y instead, right? And then they say, if we do that, it doesn't make any sense to have people throwing the stuff in the river again. So we have to force, by legislation of some kind, the internalization of costs. That is to say, the people who produce the toxicity have to clean it up. And the capitalist entrepreneur will say to you, quite correctly, that if you force me to internalize that cost, I cannot make a profit. He's right. He's absolutely right. And that's why, right, there's no exit within the structure of the system. Right? A system that's built on the endless accumulation of capital cannot get people who have power to do things which will ruin them. And doing those things will ruin them as capitalists. Okay? So, of course, they resist. And they're politically strong, and so forth and so on. You may win battle here and lose battle there on particular items and so forth. But basically, as long as we're in the framework of a capitalist system and not in a democratic egalitarian system, you can't solve that problem. You can treat it in a limited way, and that may be a virtue. That is to say, I'm all for stopping this and stopping that and so forth without any illusion that that will transform the system. Now, if you take pandemics emerge or for many reasons, and the combination of all of those reasons. Yes, of course, medical care is distributed totally unequally, right? So some people get excellent care, and most people get lousy care, and some people get in-between care. That's one of the problems, and that accumulates. So the people who get lousy care are more susceptible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in addition, we have a system in which, after all, in order to solve the medical problems, you have to do kinds of research that will enable us to figure out what a new vaccine is or what a new this or a new that. Now, of course, obviously, who does that and for what? And there are companies who do that for profit, so they only do it on some things and not on others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then we have the problem of the physicians and prescribing, right? So there's the idea of the overprescription of all kinds of medicines, which then create the mega bugs, which you then would get into the historic 100,000-year-old, if not longer, struggle between plagues and people, between germs and humans, and we're in the middle right now of a major crisis, I think, of mega bugs that is not at all clear that we're going to solve. And then there's nuclear weapons, right? Let's talk about this. Nuclear power is another question, nuclear weapons. Well, look, why do people have nuclear weapons? Well, the United States got nuclear weapons first, and they were going to use it as a monopoly, a quasi-monopoly of geopolitical power. They gave it to Britain as a junior partner, but nobody else. The Soviet Union defied them and got theirs, then France and China got theirs, then India, Pakistan, Israel, South Africa, and et cetera, got theirs. What's the point from a state of getting nuclear weapons? It's not an offensive weapon, it's a defensive weapon. If you have even two nuclear weapons, which is probably what North Korea has at the moment, it's enough to stop an invasion. Because with two nuclear weapons, if they drop one of them, just one, on Seoul, not only will it wipe out God knows how many South Koreans, but also how many Americans and how many Japanese and so forth and so on. So it is a tremendous defensive weapon. And therefore, I give you my absolute prediction that by the year 2020, we will have 25 nuclear powers at least in the world, right? Okay, because everybody wants this nuclear weapon as a defensive weapon, okay? And it's perfectly rational. If you are Iran, think of it. Just put yourself in the place of Iran. There are, 9 other known nuclear powers in the world today. 8 of them are within range of hitting Iran. Only one, North Korea, is not in range. Okay? Now, if you're sitting in the seat of government of Iran, is it irrational to say we should have a defensive weapon? Of course it's not irrational. Any sane Iranian leader would do it, and they will do it. The one thing I believe when the U.S. says it is that they're lying through their teeth when they say they don't want to develop nuclear weapons. Of course they do, and they will. They will because, I can't go into the whole geopolitics of it now, they will, right? And what it changes is geopolitical alignments. So it weakens Israel, there's no question about that, and it strengthens Iran, and it strengthens various other governments and so forth. And all this is part of a situation in which the U.S. no longer has the power to stop this, does not have that power, but no one else has the power to control the situation. So we have, in fact, a chaotic geopolitical situation in which there are 8 or 10 or 12 centers of power, right, vying with each other. Now, look, the real question before us, if we say that we're going to have a new system in 2050, and it all depends on us and what we do about it and so forth and so on between now and then, is whether what I call the imponderables will in fact explode, so to speak, before 2050. Anyway, if the other side wins, they will explode. That's no question. But before somebody can really stop it, because now nobody can really stop it, okay? And let's take them one by one. Environmental change, well, the most dramatic part of that is climate change, and everybody is talking about climate change, and the figures are devastating and so forth. However, among people who are not denialists, who are serious scientists, who accept the reality of human intervention as behind basically the climate change problem, etc., there is varying views about the speed of it and also the compensatory aspects. If you lower the, if you make one area warmer, will you make another area cooler? Will you shift agricultural production, or et cetera, et cetera? The whole question is how fast this will go, and the answer is, I'm not sure. Other people may be sure. Okay? Pandemics, right? I think it's very dangerous, but how dangerous? Is the great pandemic that's going to wipe out half of human population going to occur in 2032, or is it scheduled to occur in 2062? I don't know that. And I don't think you know that. Nuclear weapons, yes, they're a great defensive weapon for a state, but there are other people. You have non-state organizations who don't have the same necessity to survive that a state has, and who, Al-Qaeda is just one possibility, who want these weapons and want to use them because whatever. We also have the possibility of Dr. Strangelove. Look, if President Obama were to decide to drop a nuclear weapon on some country, he makes the decision. He doesn't push the button. He calls somebody, I don't know by what mechanism, some communication to some general sitting somewhere in some bunker and says, now you push the button, right? Now that general is supposed to only push the button if he gets the communication from the President of the United States. Well, we had a whole famous Dr. Strangelove book that was very successful and so forth, and it's not impossible. It's not impossible that some either nut or some person who has a particular ideology happens to be sitting on that button and pushes the button without the President of the United States telling him to push the button. So Dr. Strangelove is a possibility. It's unpredictable, but there are humans involved in this process, right? It's not just the heads of states that are involved in this process. It's supposed to be just the heads of state. That's why you have the red telephone, famous red telephone between U.S. President and the Soviet Union during all those years. It was to prevent mistakes, but mistakes could possibly happen. So let me summarize all that. All right, we have these imponderables. What we don't have is the timing on the imponderables, right? And if any of them were to occur before the end of the bifurcation process, right, it would, of course, affect the outcome. One of the possibilities in the bifurcation process is that we will still have a world system, just a different world system. But another possibility is we move into multiple small systems, as we had in the world for all of human history. We had a multiplicity of coexisting different kinds of systems. It's only very recently that we've had a single world system. So it's quite clear that if you wipe out half the world through a pandemic or through a nuclear operation or through a collapse of the climate, et cetera, what you end up with is a different kind of world into which we are creating whatever we're creating at the end of the bifurcation. Look, in Latin America these days, they talk a lot about buen vivir. Buen vivir is itself a translation from Quechua and from other indigenous languages of the Americas. And what is buen vivir supposed to mean? It's supposed to mean something like this, that growth per se is not a virtue. Growth is a cancer. What is a virtue is reflecting rationally and carefully on our ladder of values and what we want to preserve and what we don't want to preserve. Now, I often use the example in discussions about so-called development of Denmark. Denmark is a small country. In the middle of the 19th century, it was what we consider to be a backward country. It was a poor country, right? Now, whatever process they used for state development, it worked. Denmark comes out on the top, or nearly on the top, of every conceivable measure, including that of the welfare state within Denmark, right? Okay. That's a very, very expensive thing to do. If the whole world were Denmark, we'd go under. But everybody wants to be Denmark. There's no country you can go to and say, well, sorry, there's no room for another Denmark. You can't become a Denmark. So in point of fact, the reality of the world is that if we want to survive, we have to have a civilizational change. And the civilizational change means, for example, that our real standard of living as we now measure it in terms of commodities has to go down everywhere, but especially where it's high. Now, that isn't an easy message to purvey, and it isn't one that immediately is going to rally the troops everywhere, but it is a realistic reality. We cannot all be Denmark. The world doesn't have space for it. It doesn't have space. It doesn't have resources. It just can't do it. That's why we're fighting everywhere now over water. Water, you can't live without water. Well, at the moment, some people are living without water, and there's a struggle going on so that more people will be living without water in order that some people over here live with water. Well, you know, there isn't enough water for 9 million people, billion people who are living like Danes are living today. There just isn't. So we have to agree on living in a different way, a buen vivir, which requires a civilizational change that is a much greater transformation than merely solving some of these problems. Let's just take carbon emissions. I mean, I'm all for carbon, limiting carbon emissions. Tell it to the Chinese. I mean, the Chinese say, yeah, but we're behind. What does behind mean? It means we're not living at the standard of living of the United States, right? There's no reason for us to live at a level below that of the United States, right? So you've got to either give us all that you have, 50% of what you have, or you've got to let us do this or so forth. And that's why no agreement has been reached and no agreement will be reached between the United States and China about carbon emissions. That's just one of the multiple examples of the impossibility of resolving this within the framework of the capitalist world system. So there's my message.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, where we have been listening to excerpts of a Left Forum plenary session on global ecology. We welcome your comments with an email to rknight, that's R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. I'm Robert Knight for Earthwatch.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.
It's been years since Enough Said Theme was on the air here, and next Wednesday overnight, I'll be catching up on years of comics history and current events, including the mainstream, independent graphic novels, and internet comic strips with Gina Donahue and Patrick Sharp, and you, as yours truly, Ken Gale, guest host for Jim Froin's science fiction show, Hour of the Wolf, this Wednesday night, Thursday morning, July 11th, from 1:30 to 3 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Enough said. Cyclops, angel, and Doctor Strange.
Cyclops, angel, and Doctor Strange. I wanna be like them. From the age of six, they never change. I wanna be like them. I wanna be a comic book hero.
Boy, that song really gives me the charge every time I hear it. I am Ken Gale, and Jim Freund is away this week and has asked me to guest host for him and suggested that I do an episode of Enough Said. And he knew I'd say yes. He knew very well I'd say yes. And Enough Said is a show I did here from 1993 until 2002 when the program director canceled it. But it didn't even go away then because different producers let me do Enough Said segments on their shows, and I kept doing that somewhat frequently until 2007. And I missed the show. I missed talking about the subject matter. I was able to talk about the passing of Carmen Infantino, Silver Age comic strait, with Robert Knight just a few months ago. And so this time I'm sort of going to do the about 3 or 4 years worth of shows all at once. So we have an hour and a half, and I have two guests who are going to bring me up to date on what's going on in the entire world of comics. There's only thousands of comics that come out every month, if you include the internet and independents and the mainstream corporate comics. So my guests are
Patrick Sharp, now that my mic is on.
And Gina Donahue Sharp.
And, I've been friends with Gina for a while, and then I got to meet Patrick through her. And whenever we get together, they sort of catch me up a little bit on what's going on. And I love their analyses and the discussion they bring to the medium. So as soon as Jim asked me to do the show, they were the first two people I asked to come on, and here they are.
Yay, too happy to help.
All smiles. And, okay, so what's been going on? Fill me in on the last 5 years of comics.
Where to start?
Can we start with things that are funny but not entirely awesome?
You mean funny like...
Funny like the name of
humorous
that domain?
Or... Okay.
Has DC done something stupid today.com?
There's a real website.
That is a real website hosted by theouthouse.com, basically to deal with the sheer amounts of fan outrage and consternation over the various things that have been coming out of DC over the last 2 or 3 years.
For example?
Oh, well, let's see. Today, it's only been one day since DC Comics did something stupid, and that's in relation to Ale Scott being permanently taken off of the Suicide Squad comic. I don't read it. This is news to me. But that's the sort of thing they keep everybody updated on. As soon as fans on the internet go, "What's happening? Why are they doing this?" The outhouse resets the counter on "Has DC done something stupid today.com."
You can even just, they have like a mini app for your phone's home screen that'll just show you how many days it's been since DC's done something stupid. And if you want to look up what the last thing was, you can click on it.
Do they have an archive so you
yes.
can see all the
stupid things? Like, now, you know, shooting Catwoman in the head.
She's better, by the way.
She got better. There was enough outrage.
It was fake to begin with. cheap shots, left and right. That's the kind of thing coming out.
Just kidding.
There is something about comics. People can be shot, and they're not dead. They're dying, and they got saved, and
they're
cetera,
just fine.
Although I guess the main way people get revived is a new writer takes over, and they go, "No, I don't want that character to be dead."
And they figure out a way to bring them back,
or they just ignore the fact that they were ever dead in the first place. And those of you who are not fans, who are sort of, you know, looking at it as askance, I want to point out that mythology, which was religion to the people who were originally creating it, they had the same continuity problems.
Oh, yeah.
Mythology, soap operas.
Soap operas, you know.
People get brought back from the dead.
I think it's a little easier with soap operas, oddly enough.
Different actors, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't have Time Lord regeneration.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was a very clever bit on it for the Doctor Who people to, you know, "Oh, we're going to have a new actor, but we'll write that into the storyline."
Well, they had to. Their first guy died. during filming. It's like, okay, well, how do we fix this?
Oh, so they didn't intend to have that regeneration?
Nope.
They weren't. Ah. Well, he didn't die, like, on set or
well,
anything.
No,
but they were in the middle of a story, and he got too sick to continue. And so they were like, well, we have this show that we're not finished doing, and we're actually doing really well. Quick, let's have an awesome idea. So they had an awesome idea, and they brought a new guy in.
And that's how we got Patrick Trefton.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then it worked that time, so they just kept doing it.
Now, one of the conversations that we had over the last few years is about how differently Marvel and DC treat female characters, which I thought was very interesting, because that wasn't always the case. I mean, DC is the company that brought us Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Who is still an icon. And today on WBAI was a comic book show about women in comics. And though the main aspect of the show was independent comic creators in the Bronx, they're having an art exhibit up there with comic art featuring women artists in the Bronx. They talked about Wonder Woman several times in that show. So when you told me how badly DC is treating their female characters and how well Marvel is, because often if one treats their female characters badly, the other one does as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Patrick, fill us in.
Well, I don't know. I don't read the whole breadth and depth of Marvel Comics, but on the surface, they certainly seem to be doing a better job of at least giving the female characters a shot. I read the most the recent run of Extreme X-Men, written by Greg Pak. It was a Dazzler-led alternate universe X-Men team. And the fact that they let Dazzler headline a book after, you know...
Being Dazzler.
proudly branding her last comic in the 80s as, because you demanded it, the last issue of Dazzler. Giving her a chance again is
they
amazing.
Said that?
They said that.
It was right on the... Dazzler
because you demanded it the last issue.
Because you demanded it.
They said that.
And so it was really, really well done. Written by a man, Greg Pak, but it was honest to the character, and it didn't treat her like some stupid throwaway.
It was written by a fan.
Yeah.
I mean, originally she was Disco Dazzler. It shows you the
she was a gimmick character, she was a gimmick character with a shtick that was not actually common at the time. In other words, she didn't want to be a superhero. She actually just wanted to be a pop star.
Uh-huh.
And then she kept getting dragged into things and dragged down with the X-Men as
that was always
these things
kind of
happen.
The fun part.
And then she'd always go out and try and get popular again, but, you know, that kind of got messed up.
But, you know, in any case, there was that. And then within the last couple of years, they've allowed Ms. Marvel, you know, MS Marvel, Carol Danvers,
binary,
to become Captain Marvel. Changed her costume, so it's now she's not, you know, in a bathing suit. She's actually in a unitard, what covers her whole self, except
but
for her
head.
There's
a black woman who was Captain Marvel at one
That's
point.
That's right. She goes by Photon now. I don't think they knew what to do with her, but she's kind of a...
At least
she
she's
shows
not
up every
dead
once in a
retconned.
While as guest stars. That's right, not dead or retconned.
She's not dead or retconned. This is already a step up from DC.
retcon is retroactive continuity. What I was mentioning that a new writer takes over and they simply change the characterization.
Change what happened.
Yeah, everything. So it's not a continuing. It's not a continuing storyline anymore.
There's no continuity anymore, or there is, but it's fake.
Help me out here. The name of the woman who was the black Captain Marvel.
Monica Rambeau.
Monica Rambeau.
Oh yeah.
Steve Englehart
also
wrote
in,
her for a while and did a wonderful job.
Wasn't
with,
she was in Warren, she was in Next Men, right?
Yes, with Machine Man.
And Boom Boom.
Yeah. That poor character, Boom Boom, oh my god.
anyway. So, I mean, whatever.
Yeah,